Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. On today's show, we have music and conversation with Dom Flemons. Dom is a multi-instrumentalist and founding member of the Carolina Chocolate Drops. He has a new solo album called Prospect Hill. The album covers lots of ground, from ragtime to Piedmont blues to spirituals and just about every iteration of folk music you could come up with. He's playing in Winston-Salem this weekend. Then we explore a culture of food, family, and fellowship with Stephanie Tyson and Vivian Joyner. They run the restaurant Sweet Potatoes, and Chef Tyson has a new book called Soul Food Odyssey. Then it's the return of Penny Queen Bee Zamagni and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville, a.k.a. the King Bees. The New River Blues Festival is coming up this weekend, and the King Bees have a preview, live from Studio A. It's music, food, and festivals on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later on the show, we'll stir up your senses with some Southern food with a side of soul. That's the way chef and author Stephanie Tyson describes her and partner Vivian Joyner's restaurant, Sweet Potatoes. Sweet Potatoes is located on Trade Street in downtown Winston-Salem. That's also where a free concert by my guest Dom Flemons is taking place this Saturday night at Summer on Trade.
Don't need no cup of coffee in the morning. I can get up fine. I can get up fine.
Dom Flemons plays banjo, guitar, harmonica, fife, bones, percussion, quills, and he also sings. As a founding member of the Grammy-winning Carolina Chocolate Drops, he helped bring traditional music to new audiences. Alongside bandmates Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robinson, they highlighted the central role African Americans played in shaping American music. After a decade with Carolina Chocolate Drops, Dom left the group and focused on his solo material. His latest release is called Prospect Hill. I spoke with Dom from his home in Hillsboro.
I've been gone.
Prospect Hill is your third solo record, but it's your first one since leaving the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Is that right?
That's correct.
I'd like to start with talking about the decision to go solo, how that came about and what you were looking to find leaving the Carolina Chocolate Drops, especially after a point where you were so successful with the band.
Well, you know, from the beginning, you know, I was always pursuing a solo career along with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and I balanced the two back and forth for the past 10 years. I've had a completely separate repertoire of material that reflect the things that I've learned during my journey, listening to different types of music, studying it, and trying different ways of work in the music, and then also songwriting too, which I think is kind of all works together to make it happen. So when we started the Carolina Chocolate Drops, it was really important to keep it very much based in tradition and presenting music that was historical, and also being able to push the idea of black string bands and their importance to the whole scope of American popular music. And so over time, you know, we did about 10 years of that, and Rhiannon Giddens and I, the main two members, just after a while, it just kind of became time to go our separate ways. We had just different ideas of what we were wanting to do and how to run the group, and so for me, I just, you know, from the beginning, I've always been a great team player, and I thought that it was more important to try to keep the Carolina Chocolate Drops, the institution and structure, together. And when it seemed like my involvement in the group was going to make it too difficult for that to happen.
So now with your solo work, which, as you said, you've had a solo repertoire for a long time, so is it that you're getting to express more personal ideas and maybe, I don't want to say feel as boxed in, but a little more open to explore?
Well, sure, I think in some ways, yeah. In terms of personal ideas, I mean, I always put in my own personal ideas into everything that I do. You know, everybody, in the end, everybody has intentions and agenda, and when you're selecting songs that you don't particularly write wholesale, you have certain aspects of the music that are brought to the forefront because of, you know, your own personal journey. So in that way, you know, now the industry's set up in a way where people think if you don't write the song, then you don't mean it, but that's actually not true at all. And so for me, also, there was just, in terms of experimenting, too, it was like when I met the original two members, Renan and Justin, Renan could sing, but the two of them, they couldn't play a lot of keys. They just could play all the old-timey numbers, so everything was in the key of G or the key of A, or maybe the key of D. And it was very difficult because a lot of my the keys that I sing in are sharp and flat keys, and like E flat or an F or C sharp, and those are keys that we couldn't tackle at all. And so I was always a little uncomfortable in terms of my own singing voice in the group because I was restricted to the keys that everybody could play in. And so in that way, with Prospect Hill, I was able to break into a lot of different styles of music that I think previously in the Carolina Chocolate Drops, that we were just too limited to be able to do it.
Oh, little Susie, how I love you. Nothing in the world can make me snub you.
Polly, put the kettle on, kettle on, kettle on. Polly, put the kettle on. Boil a teacup, bread and butter. Good enough for anybody. Bread and butter's good enough for me.
Yeah, what I've heard of the album is very fluid, but also with a lot of variety, for sure, tonally and song structure-wise. There's some nice instrumentals, there's some vocal songs. There's songs that are, you know, more hook-driven than others. I don't know, it's a really fun and engaging record. And I'd like to go back to something you said a moment ago about the perceived notion of needing to write one's own songs exclusively. What do you do when you're tackling a classic piece of material or something that someone else has written? What do you do to give, you know, your own voice and sense of authorship to someone else's song?
Well, you know, the first thing is that you don't have to think that hard about it. If you're really thinking about what the material needs is what as an individual interpreter you can do. You know, like my background in my own academic studies is through ancient literature and, you know, reading Shakespeare and Chaucer and Beowulf and Wordsworth and, you know, and William Blake and stuff like that. And so for me, it's when you see material that you haven't written, you know, as an interpreter, you have to think about what is going to present the material in the most positive light to the audience. And then also, if you want to make it more personal, think about what drew you to the material as well. I mean, and it seems like those are very simple ideas, but you'd be surprised at how many people don't do that. They don't put themselves into the material and find, what drew me to this personally? Was it a line? Was it the rhythm of the words? Was it the beat? Was it the melody? Is it the chords? You know, there's a whole variety of ways that music can move you. And really taking that time to sit and think about that, it makes the work happen, and it makes the flow of creativity happen when you put yourself into that space.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've never seen marching like this. Dom Simmons is marching backwards up the mountain. That is the world-famous Grotto Beat.
And then the other thing I do when I'm presenting material is I try to think about what I, as an audience member, want to hear and see as well in the music. I think that you know, it's really important that especially on Prospect Hill, like if it's I did a jazz song like Until the Seas Run Dry, I wanted to make sure it sounded like a jazz number. And so, you know, I put myself in the position thinking like, okay, well, if I put this next to a very staunch traditionalist person who's heard a lot of jazz, would they really enjoy this? Because I personally am someone who's listened to a lot of old-time jazz, and I can tell the difference. You know, I can tell if it's old or new, and if it's new interpreter. You know, you tend to, you know, when you get into listening to a lot of the old records, it gets very hard to differentiate. You know, there's a quality of music that comes from the classics, and it stands the test of time. So trying to hear new music that comes up to that standard, a lot of people say, oh, well, that's already been recorded. I'm not, you know, that's already been recorded. It's been done. So I'm going to push away from that. But I found in the past couple of years, it just seems like in the post-digital world that everybody's still thinking with that mentality. But in the post-digital world, we don't even have the envelope anymore. So everybody's thinking about pushing the envelope with music when there's not even an envelope that people are reaching to. And so for me, instead of trying to push the envelope forward, I decided, well, I've done the Caroline Chocolate House for 10 years. Let me take a step back and present a variety of stuff that I already do, and then just make a really great recording of all that stuff that I already do, so that people can hear the different facets of my own musical journey that I've been on. I did each of the tracks as its own statement, so that when I came back to it, you know, after recording everything, I was able to find a story within all those recordings. And so that was how I made Prospect Hill. Was I tried to find the story after I'd recorded everything, but I made sure that that each song itself had a full statement and a full idea and a full presentation of what I was looking to do.
Too late, seems that we've run out of time. I'll always remember the love we shared. I gotta get you, baby, off my mind. Get away, get away.
And then considering the audience, you've said that it is important to you to, in some ways, take a contemporary approach. From my ears, though, the music still has a very, what some would call, you know, authentic feel, you know, lived in and an old time feeling. It's not like there's suddenly an EDM break or auto-tune or something, you know, but you know it's of now in some small ways. I mean, what are the things that you do to a song that you think contemporarize it in some ways for audiences?
Well, for Prospect Hill in particular, you know, a thing that my mentality with recording old timey songs is that when you do them, you're automatically making them contemporary by just performing them. That's already happening in itself. And so, again, with my training in older literature and sort of the linguistics around that older literature, when handling different styles, you know, there's a vocabulary. And again, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. See, if I had like a big big synth solo, or I had like a techno drums that came onto one of my tracks, it would sound a little weird. you know, for the experiment's sake, it could work. I mean, I could probably make it work if I did that. But for me, on that album, I really wanted to try to keep it very straightforward, just because everybody's kind of doing that now. It just feels like the trend is do more and put more ambient noise on it, put a big raging guitar solo on it, or, you know, whatever it might be. Or even with hip-hop, it's like put backing tracks and backing vocals on top of the backing vocals, so it's just like there's no space to even breathe in the music. And a lot of the classic songs that I really enjoy, they have space. Like when I hear Hank Williams, they have a great guitar solo, they have a great fiddle solo, pedal steel or whatever, but there's space, you know. And same thing with even Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf. There's space. Even Bob Dylan, Cream, you know, Led Zeppelin, they have space mm-hmm. in their songs, and it's really refreshing. And most times people think, oh, that's kind of old-fashioned, but I feel like now people are getting so new-fashioned about music that it's sometimes they're losing the point. And so with the album, I tried to just keep it real simple with some of the stuff. Like, you know, for example, like on Have I Stayed Away Too Long, you know, like the guitar solo starts it off. And I didn't mix it up too high. I made it like Western swing style guitar, where it was slightly lower in the mix. Then the saxophone was a little bit more raging. And that's, you know, because when you listen to old time rock and roll, that was the first rock and roll instrument, was the saxophone, coming from like jump blues like Louis Jordan. Mm-hmm. And so I made the saxophone kind of prominent. Hot Chicken, I did the exact opposite. I kind of took some inspiration from Charles Mingus's work and made the saxophone really loud and in your face. But I didn't make it too in your face because I didn't want to turn people off from, you know, if it hurts your ears, then you want to turn the music off. But I made the saxophone kind of intense and jump forward at you. And then the electric guitar solo, that became another thing to it, so it was a little bit more raging. And so those are very little things that you can do in the studio after you've recorded it that I tried to work that aspect of it. But I tried to make it very musical. I didn't want it to be a thing that, you know, as a listener, you'd have to say, oh, he was trying to do something. It's enjoyable. And then, you know, hopefully it would cause someone to want to listen to it again. And then over time, you know, you can figure out the little studio tricks that I did here and there on the record.
Have I stayed away too long? Have I stayed away too long? Now if I came home tonight, would you still be my darling? Or if I stayed away too long?
You know, love, you mentioned Have I Stayed Away Too Long, and Hank Williams. That song does remind me of something that might be in Hank's repertoire. And you also mentioned the guitar solo in there, which I'm assuming you played the guitar solo on that song as well, correct?
Oh, no, that wasn't me. That was a great studio musician by the name of Keith Gans. That was also a thing, too, I wanted to do with Prospect Hill. See, my first two records, Dance Tunes, Ballads and Blues, and then American Songster, which I then incorporate into my moniker, those two albums were done solo because that was my own roots of performing. I really enjoyed hearing solo folk performers and country blues musicians, and that was what I had on those first two records. And I'd have an occasional overdub here and there, but for Prospect Hill, I wanted to make sure it had a bigger sound. Even with being subtle, I wanted to make sure it had a bigger sound, because with it being the first album coming out from the group, I wanted to make sure that there was no doubt that I was crafting the sound having produced the record. Because, you know, with it being old-timey music, people tend to get the wrong impression. They think that it's just all, like, slapdashed, you know, done out the gate with no preconceived thought. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to make sure that the album was very good sounding, so I juxtaposed it with two different groups of musicians. One was a group of Guy Davis, Ben Hunter, and Joe Siemens. And so we did more folky stuff, so like Polly Put the Kettle On, Sonoran Church Two-Step, My Money Never Runs Out.
Now there's a flirting yellow joker living round this town. He's just as lazy can be. Now as long as they flirt, boys, he hangs around. I love my hops, is he?
Those were songs that were done with a smaller sound. And also like in the Grotto Beat, where it was a bigger sound with that ensemble. And then I decided to have a second session where I brought in these fancier studio musicians. So I had Kobe Watkins on the drums, Ron Brindle on the bass, and Keith Gans playing the electric guitar, a six-string banjo, Until the Seas Run Dry, and San Francisco Baby. And then I had Brian Horton come in doing the soprano saxophone, and then he does the tenor saxophone and the clarinet.
Sweet San Francisco baby, honey, I don't care.
So when you head out on the road touring these songs, are you taking some members of each of these bands with you? Are you going solo, or are you doing a little bit of both?
Well, you know, it's certain venues will I'll be doing solo, but for the most part, I have a trio with me. I carry with me a bassist who also doubles on fiddle by the name of Brian Farrow. And then at the moment, I have a fellow by the name of Tariq Muhammad on the drums. I also work with another fellow named Dante Pope on the drums as well. And I've just been using that trio there. We cover a good deal of the repertoire on Prospect Hill, but you know, it's between doing that, there are about, I'm gonna say, like four or five songs that aren't on Prospect Hill. Some of the tracks that we perform are from the Record Store Day EP that I did called What Got Over. And then there's the repertoire of songs that I've had over the past 15 years, and some of the stuff I have the band with me, and other stuff I just do solo. So it's a combination of me playing solo and then playing with the ensemble. And we have stuff that's more old-timey, and then we have stuff that's more kind of like jazzy with the bass and drums. We also do some of the rock and roll repertoire, like in like I Can't Do It Anymore. And so we get a good balance of everything in there.
Long black hair.
It's been a very interesting journey to see the way that music is changing all the time. And I tend to talk a lot about the post-digital revolution world of music compared to the pre-digital revolution world, where, you know, we don't tend to think in those terms right at the moment, but that single thought alone, it is something that's changing the way that we listen and produce music every day now. And, you know, the album that I did with Prospect Hill, and also kind of the stuff I advocate for, those are very important parts of the American musical landscape. Some of it is very old, and other stuff is a little bit more contemporary, but it's something that I'd encourage people to look into and to research. And not only is it amazing history, there's some wonderful and amazing personalities that come with the music, and then also it's just really good music as well. And I would inquire anybody who kind of feels that they want to get into something new that sounds different, that's not nearly as formally structured as we tend to find a lot of the contemporary pop music, just to get a different sound in their ears, I'd recommend that people look up some of this old-timey stuff.
There's so much out there, Dom. Where would someone start? What would be a couple of maybe good places for someone to start on their journey? They hear Prospect Hill and they want to dig further back and look at some of the things that might have inspired it.
There'd be a few things. For the string band stuff, I'd recommend an album on Smithsonian Folkways called Black Banjo Songsters of North Carolina and Virginia. That's one CD. And that'll tell you a little bit about the roots of black banjo playing and string band music, and how it influenced jazz and ragtime and blues music as we know it. I'd also look up some of the albums from the nonprofit organization I work with, Music Maker Relief Foundation. There's some really wonderful contemporary blues artists that play some of the older folk styles, and they're living now, which is really great. And them being a nonprofit, helping these musicians with the functional support that they need to keep making that music, it's a really wonderful organization. So I've been on the board with them since 2009.
Well, Dom Flemons, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me today, and I'm sure everyone here in Winston-Salem looks forward to your concert at Summer on Trade.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be a really fun time there. You know, when we get going with the trio, it'll get people hopping, so I'm hoping people will bring their dancing shoes, want to get up and shake a leg, and it's always a really wonderful time.
Dom Flemons. His latest album is Prospect Hill, and we've been sampling from it throughout the interview. Dom is playing a free show on Saturday, September 5th at 7 p.m. as part of the family-friendly Summer on Trade music series in downtown Winston-Salem. To see a video from Prospect Hill, and for links to more music and details on Summer on Trade, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We have to take a short break, but when we return, it's Southern food with a side of soul when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later on the show, we head over to Studio A for a blues-fueled preview of the 13th annual New River Blues Festival. But first, Bethany Chafin and a pair of well-known local restaurateurs.
Sweet Potatoes Restaurant is a culinary institution located in Winston-Salem. The restaurant was started by chef and Winston-Salem native Stephanie Tyson and her partner Vivian Joyner in 2003. Sweet Potatoes and its recipes have been featured in The New York Times, USA Today, and Our State. Stephanie now has a new cookbook titled Soul Food Odyssey and will be participating in this year's Bookmarks Festival of Books and Authors. Soul Food Odyssey takes readers and fellow food enthusiasts on Stephanie's journey into the food and recipes of her grandmother's generation. She teaches readers as she herself learns the art of new dishes, how to cook from the entire pig, and recalls her adventures in turkey frying. Through it all, Tyson discusses the relationship of soul food and Southern food. She says, soul food was like the fighter George Foreman, who would stand there, flat-footed, and go toe-to-toe. Her vision of Southern food was like Muhammad Ali. She says, a little prettier with fancier footwork, but the results were the same. They were both great fighters. Stephanie and Vivian joined me at WFDD to discuss Soul Food Odyssey.
It has been a journey to get past my resentment of having the restaurant being labeled a soul food restaurant. And that, in part, was the negative connotation of soul food, the lacking in nutritional value, the lacking in imagination. I didn't think of it as a cuisine. It was just, soul food. So the journey has been to, in reevaluating and looking at exactly what the term was something that they labeled in the 60s as, you know, part of the whole black movement towards self-realization. But the food is based on slave food, basically. It's very difficult to make something from nothing. There's an art to that. It takes some coaxing and to get flavor from things and to add flavor to when you have minimal. And looking at what they would have called my grandmother cooked soul food. She didn't. She just, it was just food is what we ate. But she could take bones and make them just sing. There's an art to that. It's just not throwing stuff together and adding fat to things. It's actually coaxing flavor from vegetables. And it's been a journey to get to realizing that it's okay. It's okay if someone wants to, you know, label us a soul food restaurant, I'm okay with that. As long as they come and experience the food. It's always going to be a process of learning new things because some of the stuff I just didn't know about or how to prepare. So it's when people talk to me now, they're telling me, oh, well, we do it this way and we've done it this way and you can add this to that. So it's going to hopefully be a continuous odyssey for me, getting to the food in the South, as well as African-Americans that actually fed us. And it fed us equally at some point because we all ate the same food in the South because we all had nothing. So it will hopefully continue, and I'll continue to learn from different people that cook.
One of the phrases you've used in this book is, I think it was like survival cuisine, because it's not only creating something out of very little, it's creating something very substantial and that someone can subsist on. And so you say that's an art, and how do you go about starting to learn that art? How much of that came from family, came from traditional maybe classroom learning styles and things like that?
Well, no, they never went over this in the classroom. I went to culinary school, and you know, and that was all fine and good. But examining what my grandmother cooked, how she cooked, where she cooked, because she actually cooked in restaurants in town, as well as for a couple of white families in town. And these restaurants, cafes, were where you could go and for very little get a pretty good meal. I mean, it was, you know, beans or fried chicken or fish or vegetables. And I remember her working there, and I thought, didn't think much of it because the places didn't look like too much. They're, you know, by today's standards, we dive. But they fed a lot of people really, really late at night when they needed it. And they needed it for many reasons. Sometimes you're working third shift at a factory, or sometimes you're getting off on a second shift job, or sometimes you've been out doing some drinking at one of the beverage houses here.
It's called a liquor house.
Yes. Well, yeah. So you needed something to soak up that. And you needed something to get you going or finish your night off. So the food was, in hindsight, they did a lot with a little bit of equipment. I mean, because my grandmother described, you know, having like a pot that she fried out of and a pot that she had beans on and a cast iron pan that she made cornbread in. And that wasn't a lot. And I need a lot of stuff. I need my equipment. I need my stove, my fryer. I need all this stuff. But she seemed to have done a lot more with a lot less. I don't think you can teach that. You can kind of watch that and ask questions. And people talk when you ask them, how do you do this? I mean, and they're happy to do so. They're happy to share. And that also is been the journey about what is soul food, is sharing.
And that's for a lot of people. It is, you know, a lot of families, a lot of homes. Somebody cooked, and they cooked a lot of food from a very little, and they fed a lot of mouths. And I remember my dad was from South Carolina, and he moved to D.C. after the war, World War II. So he moved to D.C. in 46, 47. And there was a place called Florida Avenue Grill, which recently celebrated 75 years in business. And he would go there because it was food that was familiar. But it's also food that fed him in many ways, because food does that. It feeds not only the stomach, but it feeds the soul. And when he was feeling under the weather, he could go there and he could get a cup of pot liquor, which was the greens juice. And he remembered telling us about for 5 cents, he could get a cup of pot liquor. And 2 days later, he'd be feeling like $100 again. And that says something. That says something about a restaurant. It says something about the cuisine. It says something about the love that goes into it. And that's what Stephanie does with the food that we prepare at Sweet Potatoes. That's what the book is about. It's about not just taking a piece of meat and getting some flavor to it, but it's about why and how and the purpose behind it. And so we have a little slogan at the restaurant. It may not be soul food, but it's food that's good for the soul.
We talk about food feeding the body and feeding the soul, and that seems to suggest this completeness, a well-roundedness. And as far as completeness, you know, this book really addresses using the complete animal and how that's important. And I wonder if you could talk about using some things maybe you hadn't used in the past, especially parts of the pig and some of the things you made for the first time.
I, I'm a avid pork fan, but, you know, I was limited in what I, you know, the leaner parts. The other things, rooter to tooter, you know, I'm a little squeamish, pig's feet, and I never cooked them before, and I used pigtails to season with, but and I didn't actually eat it. I just didn't like it. And I've never cooked chitlins. And so that was like a process. It was an interesting process. My sous chef, Willie, is old school. So he was showing me, I bought some. It comes in a tub. And so he showed me how to clean them and clean them and clean them.
You gotta clean chitlins more. Really well.
Really well, because it is the intestines of a pig. And then how to prepare them, add some flavor. And I was actually surprised at the texture. I was expecting to be all rubbery and, but it was actually surprisingly very tender. And they were really good. That said, I wouldn't make a habit of eating them, because it really is a process. And it's a long cooking process. But normally I like things that take a long time to cook. I like that, because you can get flavor that way. I've actually done pork cheeks, which I thought were pretty good. I just really kind of interesting how you can get something from the same animal and it tastes so totally different. And so
most people just do pork chops and city
ribs,
ham,
you know, and
ham, some ribs.
Not country ham, because it's salty, but only after it's cured. But so it's been that the pig discovery has been really interesting, and so I kind of tweaked some things to make it more palatable for myself, like frying the chitlins. Actually, for me, works. It gives it a different texture. So I started doing some things with, you know, a salad with the fried chitlins and
pesto
and the collard green pesto. Yeah, I thought was interesting, because it just gave it a whole different flavor, different presentation. I probably like pork a lot better than I like beef. It's probably a little cheaper, which is why we ate so much pork and chicken, because beef was just expensive.
But most people, if they have been vegetarian for a while, like you were, they pretty much stay away from pork and just do chicken and fish.
I know. I understand. It's just
as you dove back in.
Right back into the pork.
And what brought you back?
Country ham. The smell of country ham cooking, the smell is, even if you are a vegetarian, it's got to be intoxicating.
That smell, and fried chicken.
Things frying.
You're talking about a lot of things that speak to the senses. You know, the sound of something frying, the smell of something frying. How much are the senses a part of soul food and Southern food? The other senses aside from taste, maybe, although they're all related.
For us, it's all related. When you come to sweet potatoes, it's about the food, but it's about the space. So though we're small and not very fanciful, we want to try and be comfortable. We have jazz playing in the background, but not as secondary music. It's loud enough to hear it. It is a part of the environment. The smells, the flavorings, the taste, the presentation, it's all part of it. You know, just to put something on your plate and it look pretty but not be seasoned, it's not good. To put something on a plate and it be well seasoned but look like garbage would not be very appetizing. So our home or our restaurant is our plate. And so whatever we put in there, we want it to try and be as pleasing as possible.
Well, Stephanie, could you paint a picture of what Winston-Salem looked like when you were growing up? You mentioned so many more restaurants, you know, local convenience stores, where things were easily accessible and people were cooking a lot. What were some of those restaurants you remember?
It was sort of interesting. There were a lot of African-American businesses in Winston-Salem. My world was East Winston. I mean, I didn't know anything outside of that. We shopped We paid our bills. Everything was there. So if you wanted to eat out, you went somewhere in East Winston because, one, back then that was where you could go. Even in the 60s and 70s. So my world was, I mean, there was a black bus company up until, I guess, maybe I was maybe 10 or 11 when they merged or were bought out or whatever.
That was Safe Bus?
Mm-hmm, Safe Bus. It was the only black-owned bus company in the country. So my world was that bus route, wherever that went. Downtown was 4th Street and
Liberty
Street. Lots of businesses on Liberty Street, like Sam's and Jerome's and places like that, where we shopped. But Trade Street was not we're not allowed to go onto Trade Street. My grandmother called it the Buzzard Roost. It was totally different than it is now in that what it was just trade people, you know, hardware store. But there were some really disreputable places like bars and stuff, a bar that just like, you know, which just wasn't good. And then it went through like a whole other thing in the 70s where they made it into a walking mall. So because of that, it was closed off to traffic. So you had all these bums hanging out. And then you put an X-rated movie theater there. So it was just really seedy. When we moved back, it's like there's our arts district. And it's like, what? There's no arts district here. Trade Street had started to like blossom a little bit. They had planted the seeds and it was starting to come up a little bit when we first moved back. So our space was abandoned. It's like, wow, I love this space. I mean, it's a real neighborhood with, you know, the other tenants coming out, just like in the movie, sweeping in front of their stores and just getting rolling out the sign or whatever. So it's been a joy to be a part of that in the beginning and to see where we are now. We've gone forward, but to a certain degree, we've gone backwards because there aren't as many black-owned businesses now. We aren't self-sufficient as we used to be. And it's very difficult for us to become that way. You know, the loan process makes it hard to become independent business person, which apparently it was not back then because, you know, funeral homes are still there because we take care of our own from beginning to end. And I like that. But the things in between, we've lost. We've lost our sense of entrepreneurship. I mean, even from the guy, when I grew up, there was a guy, Mr. Hicks, who used to come by and sell these top-notch clothing from the trunk of his car. Now, that's the spirit that I think made America. And we've lost that. Is gone by way of not caring or apathy. I mean, it's just, that is a shame. Even though my Chris and Bud's and all these places are gone, they left their mark because I still remember, and there are lots of people out there that do.
So my Chris and Bud's, those were cafes?
Yeah, I think you just, it wasn't anything fancy. We had, I think, a lot more, even though we had a lot less. We had a lot less rights, but we've given up so many of them.
Well, that speaks back to the food as well. There's more types of food available to us now, but nobody cooks or knows how to cook it. So even though you have all this food, what do you do with it? And what do you do with it that really sustains you or you get the best or the most out of that product? The food of this book, the food that Stephanie has in her soul, in her heart, it is the food that connects people. And if we look more to the things that join us together and less to the things that separate us, we'd be a lot better off. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter who you are. There's something on that plate that you can enjoy.
Stephanie Tyson and Vivian Joyner. The two started Sweet Potatoes Restaurant in Winston-Salem in 2003. Stephanie's new cookbook is titled Soul Food Odyssey and is available through John F. Blair Publisher. Stephanie will be presenting at Bookmark's Festival of Books and Authors on Saturday, September 12th at 1:30. She'll also be on the Chef's Picks panel at 3:30. For more information, visit our website at wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Try Out Arts Weekend.
Associate Producer Bethany Chafin. This is Try It Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We have one more break, but when we return, we're Carolina bound with the King Bees when Try It Arts Weekend continues.
Going to the Carolinas, we're Carolina bound. Going to the Carolinas, we're Carolina bound.
Welcome back to Try It Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. If this Labor Day weekend, cool mountains and hot blues are on your agenda, you're probably headed to the 13th annual New River Blues Festival. The outdoor concert takes place in Grassy Creek at the River House Inn on Sunday, September 6th. The lineup includes Travis Moonchild Haddix, Get Shorty, Veronica Jackson, Lady D, Lawyers Guns and Money, and today's guest, the King Bees. Bassist and vocalist Penny Queen Bee Zamagni and guitarist and keyboardist Rob Hound Dog Baskerville are co-directors of the festival. They played a live set at WFDD Studios back in 2013. They spoke with David Ford.
This next tune, I mean, I just love the name of this one. Everyone loves Ham Hock Stew. I know this is a bitter love song.
Well, there is a certain kind of blues that to me is a little bit pretentious. It's the Chardonnay. I won't mention the artist who does a lot of blues with that kind of sophisticated stuff going on. But let's get down to it. The real blues folks don't drink Chardonnay or eat filet mignon. They eat Boston Button. They eat ham hock stew or whatever.
Right. We've seen this.
We've been around it.
Well, how did this tune come about, though, besides the reality, the earthiness of the stew? I hope it's not a true life story.
I love Penny's intro. She often does live, which sort of explains a bit of what
that
you're asking.
The song may not be a true story, but I will say that I did write it, and that my husband can't cook a lick. So imagine how you would feel after a hard day of work when you walk in the door and the house smells like home cooking. And you know he doesn't cook. So what is your first emotion?
I'm not lying this time, baby.
Suspicion. You're suspicious. So that's what this song is about.
All right.
Thank you.
to throw away the ball.
The King Bees, live in WFDD Studio A. They're behind the 13th annual New River Blues Festival. The festival's in Grassy Creek at the River House Inn on Sunday, September 6th. You can find full lineup and ticket information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Triad Arts Weekend's executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our contributing editor is Kike Rodriguez-Pastor. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to our guests, events, videos, and more on our website, wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well. Our handle is Triad Arts Speak. And be sure to like WFDD on Facebook. Triad Arts Weekend is a production of 88.5 WFDD, public radio for the Piedmont. I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.